get. Oh, the overall cost of health care in the U.S. is so high, not available, or people simply couldn't afford it. It is also a factor in how much we spend on incarcerating individuals, many of whom are in jail because of behavioral and drug problems that might not have gotten out of hand had the individuals been able to take advantage of preventive care. So this hour, we're going to talk about preventive care in general and specifically about preventive care for those with drug and behavioral issues. We're joined by Jane Goble-Clark, Executive Director of the Center for Prevention Services, which focuses on substance abuse prevention in families, at school, and in the workplace. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Connie Mealy is Director of Provided Behavioral Health Services for Mecklenburg County. She recently served as President of the North Carolina Foundation for Alcohol and Drug Studies Board. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And John Emerson is Deputy, this is a scary title, John Emerson is Deputy Director with the Atlanta Carolinas High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, and don't be afraid, Mike.
Do you have time to be here? I mean, if we are in the high drug trafficking area, do you have time to be here?
I do.
Okay.
It's an important subject.
All right. Now, Jane, you've been working in preventive medicine for a while now. And,
yes.
And you say that preventive medicine is a kind of a hidden field. Why?
I believe that because it's really hidden in plain sight. Part of that is our cultural norm in this country. We've been a very comfortable, wealthy nation for generations. The result of that is because we've had extra money and power to spend on the back end of things, on research and treatment. Our country hasn't had the need to focus on preventing issues.
So you're saying it didn't matter that we were spending more to play catch-up when we could have spent less to prevent the thing in the first place because we were loaded. That's what you're saying.
It's that age-old statement, you know, even about our own pocketbooks. The more you have to spend, the more you spend.
Yeah.
And I think that's really part of the mindset.
How much of that had to do with the fact, A, that people had insurance through their employer that they had no idea what it cost, so they just waited till they got sick to take advantage of it? And how much of it had to do with a lot of insurance policies not paying for preventive care?
A little of both. Prevention hasn't been paid for by insurance companies, but that's because of that cultural mindset. So if we live in a country that doesn't need to focus on prevention, then as a general rule, you're talking about, you know, do we not focus on that as individuals because we have insurance that covers it or our employers take care of the insurance plans? It's really a global mindset. If our culture or the box that we live in doesn't have that perspective, then we as individuals don't typically have that perspective.
So is that changing now because we recognize that the rising cost of health care is going to bankrupt us all, and also because of the Affordable Care Act making it available to those who buy into the program?
Certainly the costs have brought this to the forefront of public chatter and focus. The 2008 economy crash, I think, brought a lot of focus on where we can save money. I think more importantly than that even is the 2010 Affordable Care Act, the requirement to create something called a national prevention strategy. When we think about health reform in this country, unfortunately, that phrase health reform has become a little politicized. And so people hear the soundbite health reform, and they have a lot of gut reactions to that without hearing the phrase health reform, reshaping health for our country. The Affordable Care Act mandated the creation of this national prevention strategy in 2010, created a National Prevention Strategy Advisory Council. These are all mandatory pieces of the Affordable Care Act. And the whole point, it was actually a historical document because it was cross-sector with the federal government. I think there were 17 different federal agencies that came together to put this document in action. So it's things like Department of Ed, Department of Transportation, insurance, behavioral health, you name it, sort of across the board, these federal agencies came together to put this plan out to reform the way that we do health and wellness in our country. Now, the irony is prevention is the key to health reform. Prevention is health reform. It is the heart of the Affordable Care Act. But there's so much political stuff around that, and there's so much there's just such a lack of awareness, I think, about prevention in general that despite the fact we have this national strategy, nobody knows about it.
Yeah, I've never heard of it before.
No.
Before yesterday.
Yeah.
You say that prevention is about. Did you want to say?
I was just going to say that. You know, I think for a long time people have talked about our health care management in this country, and we don't have health care management in this country. We have disease management.
Yes.
In this country. We have not been about managing people's health. Mm-hmm. We've been about managing the disease. Mm-hmm. And so we've always been focused on that, which has kept us from really investing in prevention. And you're right, prevention isn't paid for. You know, the argument I get asked all the time is, well, how do we know prevention works? Well, my first quip back is, well, how do we know it doesn't work? Because prevention does work, but it takes money and it takes a commitment. And when you have people who are already suffering from diseases or conditions, then you want to pay for that, and prevention gets put on the back burner.
Well, because it's hard to prove a negative. And mm-hmm. if you're not sick, why am I throwing money at you so that you don't get sick? You may never get sick.
Exactly.
So how do you convince people to do that?
There's a classic example of that, and none of us question it because it's part of the social norm. We have childhood inoculations in this country to prevent our kids from catching disease. We all do it. Most everyone does it. I'll qualify that statement. So by 5 years old, our kids are safe and have built up immunities against many diseases that third world countries are still fighting against. That's prevention in the true sense of the word. And so we know that it works. You give them the shot, it protects them from getting A, B, and C disease. It's a great example of how prevention works and how we put money into prevention in one small sense. Huh. But we don't broaden that same perspective across the board in health management or disease management.
Well, you say that prevention is about advocacy, mm-hmm. about education, about making efforts to strengthen the health of individuals, families, and community, which I think seems rather complicated for what I've always perceived as something pretty simple. You get checkups, you eat right, you exercise, you stay healthy.
It seems simple.
People not know that?
You know, we might know the rules, but that doesn't mean we follow them. And more importantly than that, especially if we're talking about prevention from the behavioral health side or the right. substance abuse side, there's a stigma to this side of healthcare, and people won't talk about it. So if you don't talk about it, you can't treat it, you can't ask for help, you can't recognize the fact that 3 out of 5 people around you, maybe including you, are suffering from these same illnesses.
I also think that we're a nation of quick fixes. Mm-hmm. And so if I don't feel well and I go to my doctor,
give me a pill.
Exactly. I gave you my copay. I don't care if I have a virus. Okay, you can't give me an antibiotic, but give me a decongestant. Give me an antihistamine. I want something in return for my copay. And so, again, I think we're very focused on I don't feel well. I want to feel better or differently, and how can I do that? And, I think someone gets diagnosed with high blood pressure. It's, okay, well, I'll take a pill for that. No, I'm not going to change my eating. I'm not going to change my exercise. I'll just take a pill. That'll make it all better, not really thinking about some of the side effects that a person may experience and end up developing some problems later in life from taking that medication.
And, of course, right. over time, as you take more and more pills for what ails you, all that stuff adds up over time.
Yes.
It's not a good thing.
No.
All three of you deal in the area of drug abuse and behavioral problems. How big an impact? And you said there's a stigma attached to this. So mm-hmm. how big an impact does preventive care, or could preventive care, have in that area?
So one example that comes to mind is if we think about just one of those childhood immunizations, I think it's the MMR shot, measles, mumps, rubella. It's $150 for one shot. And, you know, usually you end up with 20 different rounds of shots throughout childhood. So this one shot's $150. That investment of $150 spares the child from catching the disease, which would then have the hospital cost or the emergency cost, the medical cost, the cost of suffering, perhaps a physical disability, so that then there are costs accrued at the schools where they might need some kind of special education requirements. Then there's the cost to society if this child is so has so many disability challenges that then they need special workforce needs or other governmental help. The cost for not doing prevention add up very easily. And a lot of the economic costs that we're dealing with, I mean, things like traffic accidents even, can be tied back into not preventing something like underage drinking or drinking while driving. It goes back to the social norm set again, I think. Because we don't focus on prevention or we don't really understand or think about prevention, we don't realize how much the culture around us impacts us. So we were just talking about the tendency to take prescription drugs. I've got an ailment, so fix me with this prescription. What's happened now is that our culture has begun fighting an epidemic of prescription drug abuse. But when you think about the society around us, the messages that we get, if you turn onto the TV tonight with your children and watch how many prescription drug ads come on,
it's cars or drugs.
Right. And that's setting the social norm.
Yeah. And that's happened. Although most of those drug commercials are in the evening news programs, which are aimed at people over 50. So the kids aren't watching those shows. However, last spring, 30 children were expelled, or around 30 children mm-hmm. were expelled from the South Carolina or South Charlotte private school mm-hmm. for heroin use and prostitution. I guess the prostitution was what, to pay for the heroin?
That would be my guess.
And that tells us that these kinds of activities are not just sequestered in low-income, high-crime areas. They can be and are, in fact, everywhere and involve no gender. They're not gender-specific. They're not class-specific. They're not economically directed. And you just mentioned, Jane, that 3 out of 5 people are directly affected by addiction or mental health issues. Mm-hmm. That sounds like an enormous number. Is that really true? How do we know 3 out of 5?
I can go back
60%?
To the office and find the stats, but that's a fairly accurate statistic.
That's 60% of the people walking around.
That's the point. There's so much stigma, we don't realize that everybody's got a little bit of something that they're challenged with. Because of the stigma, we're afraid to reach out and say, I'm suffering from depression this week, and realize that your boss is too. I mean, not just this week, but maybe for 6 months. Maybe because you're not talking about it, it turns into suicidal ideation. The not talking about it means we don't realize that, you know, half of us in this room today might have some challenge or another.
And I think, you know, part of that is what we're talking about when we're talking about behavioral illnesses, including addiction, are brain diseases. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, brain diseases aren't really any different than heart disease. It's just a different part of the body. And the person who has heart disease needs to make changes in their life, behavioral changes in their life, as does a person with a brain disease. But it's okay to have a heart attack and have everybody rally around you, but enter treatment for substance abuse or depression, and nobody talks to you. A parent shared with me that she had 2 children, one who developed cancer, and the family and the church and the neighbors and everyone rallied around and brought food and helped clean the house and do all kinds of things while her child was getting treatment for cancer. Her other child developed an addiction and was in treatment for addiction, and nobody called and nobody came by and nobody offered any support.
That's because we have people like John Emerson
who
go after these people who are bad guys because they deal with or drugs. They either deal drugs or they take drugs or they're involved in drug trafficking. I'm going to bring you into this conversation if it kills me. And we'll do it after the break because we have to take a break here. We're talking about preventive care, particularly with an idea as we go through the rest of the show with a focus on getting help for drug and mental health problems before they get out of hand. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation presenting Old Crow Medicine Show August 21st at Uptown Amphitheater Charlotte. Tickets available at livenation.com. Well, speaking of entertainment, there was a time before the NFL. There was a time before the NBA. There was a time, not too long ago when wrestling was the king of sports in Charlotte, pro wrestling. And Charlotte was the epicenter of that sport. In fact, a lot of big-time wrestlers actually lived in Charlotte. Well, the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest is coming to town beginning on Thursday, and I'm told it's the last one they'll ever have, a chance for fans to reunite with some of their favorites. But before that happens, we're going to have our own SmackDown. We've invited some professional wrestlers, including my friend Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, to join us on the program, and we'll talk about that sport and what it really is tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, death and personal injury claims related to faulty ignition switches in 2.6 million GM cars can be filed starting on Friday. Ken Feinberg, who led victim compensation after 9/11 on the victims' claims against GM.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about preventive care and the important role it can play, could play, if people took advantage of it, with regard to drug abuse and also behavioral issues, mental health issues, with Connie Mealy, who is Director of Provided Behavioral Health Services for Mecklenburg County, Jane Goble-Clark, Executive Director of the Center for Prevention Services, and John Emerson, who's Deputy Director of the Atlanta Carolinas High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. Let's bring John into the conversation here. There is a stigma attached to getting help for mental health issues and for drug abuse issues. As Connie just said, people rally around people who have physical problems like heart attacks and strokes and cancer and things like that. But when a son or a daughter or even you are discovered to have a drug problem and you have to go to rehab or you have to get help some other way, there is this stigma. You don't want to tell anybody in the neighborhood that I'm having a drug problem. That just doesn't. Is part of that because we have been treating people who have these drug problems, which are medical issues, like criminals?
Well, yes and no. I mean, at some point, obviously, when you get to the trafficking phase where we come in, you know, selling drugs is illegal. So, you know, we have to act to try to, you know, try to keep a little bit of a lid on the distribution of drugs. You know, the prevention part of it and the treatments part of it has been a different side. You know, we fill one of those three pillars where we're trying to, you know, stop a lot of the crime that goes on behind drug use and drug trafficking, you know. But all of us in law enforcement, I think, agree that we're not going to wrest our way out of this problem. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we would like to see increased prevention so that you don't need so many of us as us and so much of an investment in law enforcement and incarceration because it was prevented in the first place, you know. And we'd like to see more help from the schools at all different levels so that kids know the dangers of drugs because, you know, there's a direct correlation between their perception of risk and how often they're going to use drugs. And the less perception of risk, the more chance they're going to use drugs. And right now that perception of risk by all studies is very low.
But are they going to listen to the old guys like you and the rest of us in this room who are over 18? Are they going to listen? Are they going to listen to us?
Maybe yes and maybe no. But there are good programs out there, you know, and that's really what becomes important is have the right evidence-based programs in the school system, so they do get the right message. And there are, and you can go on the websites for SAMHSA or NIDA. There's somewhere between 35 and 100 evidence-based, statistically proven prevention methods at work, mm-hmm. but you have to make those prevention methods available to kids, and they're not.
You are the deputy director for the Atlanta Carolinas High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. That would indicate to me that the Atlanta Carolinas corridor is a high intensity drug trafficking area. What makes us so? How big is the problem?
So we're designated by counties, right? So this is a three-state area that I work in, Atlanta, Carolinas, and there's 15 counties designated by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Is it the I-85 corridor? Is that what that is?
Well, the counties themselves are designated, right? Okay. So certainly the I-85-40 corridor contributes to mm-hmm. the movement of drugs from the southwest border directly to us, directly to Atlanta, directly to South Carolina. But what makes this a high-intensity area is the fact that there are significant levels of drug trafficking here that are connected to other drug trafficking organizations throughout the United States and requires the need of additional federal resources to combat that problem. And that's how that designation came about.
None of this would be happening, of course, if there was no demand for these drugs. So who's buying?
Well, it's at every level. I mean, you're talking about kids from 12 and 13. We have a lot of initiation uses up to 50s, 60s, every race, ethnic, gender, religious class. I mean, drug trafficking, drug use, drug abuse shows no bounds.
And what is being bought? What are the primary drugs that are being trafficked through this area?
Well, still, marijuana is still the most commonly available drug. Prescription pills, another significant problem. And unfortunately, heroin is now a major problem in the Charlotte area, as it is in throughout the United States. But you can see a big push for it now throughout the United States. But I can tell you, it came to our attention back in 2007, the growing heroin problem, black tar heroin from Mexico. We've been dealing with major organizations bringing intentionally targeting Charlotte and certain other U.S. cities with bringing black tar heroin into this area.
How do you intentionally, if you're a person in Mexico, how do you intentionally target anything? How do you intentionally target Charlotte?
Well, they look at the demographics. I mean, they're, you know, it's not like there aren't people from these organizations that have been trafficking cocaine, marijuana, methamphetamine into here for years. And they see the availability of the market. They see an affluent community. And most of this heroin problem now is affecting more middle to upper class kids than it is, you know, poorer people.
How do they use it?
Heroin?
Yeah.
Well, it's generally snorted first, but then generally it's going to lead to injection within, you know, the third or fourth use. Or with,
why? Because you don't get the high you used to get on the first use?
Yeah, you're trying to replicate that first high. You know, and with injecting, you're going to get a more instantaneous reaction directly into the bloodstream. And once you go there, you know, it's very difficult to go back.
Now, I know this is about prevention, but I have to ask, because if you're taking drugs for the high that you're going to get for the drugs, I suppose it could be because it starts out as a fun thing to do or it's an experiment. John told me he got really blown away, and let's try this. It could be an exciting thing, I suppose. But that also indicates an underlying behavioral issue, it seems to me. After repeated use, you either need to do it because you're addicted or you want to do it in the first place because you're trying to change something about your life. Is that right?
That would be correct, Mike. You know, people, what we have seen over the years is that a lot of times people start using drugs and alcohol just for experimentation, as John said. You know, everybody's doing it. I want to try it. I want to see what it's all about and see what happens. When anybody does that and they are someone who has a genetic predisposition to developing the disease of addiction, which means they have a parent, grandparent, great-grandparent, aunt, uncle, somebody who already had the disease of addiction, they have a 50% to 60% greater chance of having the disease themselves.
So anybody can become addicted.
Yes.
But you may have a predisposition to be becoming addicted.
Yes, exactly. And what we know now is that we have about 30,000 genes in our body, and we've identified 89 that are specifically related to addiction. Now, as someone who, as a nurse and someone who's worked in addiction for a long time, right, what's exciting about that is that hopefully someday we can do blood tests on young people and say, you know what, out of 89, and I'm sure there's more, but we've only identified 89 genes, but out of 89 genes, you 78 genes.
So you better not play around.
Yeah, really. You're really playing Russian roulette if you go ahead and try this, as opposed to the child who has four genes. And so hopefully then with prevention programs and that knowledge, you know, people can make more informed decisions.
But kids today are also experimenting with prescription drugs,
yes,
that they steal out of their mom's medicine cabinet or their purse or wherever the those drugs are kept. And they're taking them for the same reason. Getting back to a behavioral issue, what are they trying to achieve? Are they trying to escape something in their lives, or are they simply trying to enhance their life through this new experience?
I think it can be any of those. I think, again, originally kids do it because they want to know what it feels like and want to see what everybody's talking about, want to fit in with a certain crowd. So they do it for those reasons. If they have the genetic predisposition, then what very well may happen is then they start using it because they liked how it made them feel. It made them feel – what I've had people tell me over and over is that it made me feel like a version of myself I never felt before, and I liked how that felt. Not that it was necessarily high. It just felt good.
And then we have these different classes of drugs, but drugs are drugs. I mean, we have prescription drugs, which are legal drugs, which if prescribed and used in the manner they were intended to be used, they are beneficial even though they have side effects. But if you use them in a manner that they are not intended to be used, you can get a different effect, obviously, but it can be a deleterious one. Then we have things like heroin and cocaine and marijuana and alcohol. Are we sending mixed messages? I mean, I know kids also experiment with alcohol, which is a drug, but you can buy. The state of North Carolina is in the alcohol selling business.
It's the social norms again. We think about alcohol as a rite of passage when kids go to college, and the fact that the general perception is, oh, you're going to go to college in that first year or 2 years, you're going to party, and that's the expected norm. That is a mixed message. We're saying, don't do this till you're legal. Don't do this if it's going to make you have unhealthy behaviors. But then we accept it when it happens.
And John, you said there's a lot of marijuana being trafficked through the Carolinas and Atlanta. And we're really changing our attitude around the country on marijuana. After years of some people mm-hmm. advocating it's being legal for medical use and now legal in some places for recreational use, the states have done it. The federal government has not. And yet the federal government seems to be turning a blind eye to marijuana use in the states where they have made it legal for recreational or medical use. It appears that way, at least. Where would you put marijuana on the scale?
Well, it's still, I mean, people don't like to hear it. They say it's so passe to say it, but it's a gateway drug. I mean, 65% of kids who begin using
drugs. Why isn't alcohol a gateway drug?
Well, it can be. You know, alcohol can be. We don't generally see the track from alcohol to heroin, though. But you will see a track from marijuana to heroin. You know, you don't find everyone that started drinking alcohol started with some other drug first. I mean, kids shouldn't be drinking alcohol. They shouldn't be under 21. They shouldn't be drinking alcohol, just like they shouldn't be smoking pot. All those things can be bad for you. Especially, you know, we know now that addiction is age onset, you know, affects the dose you use, affects things. So, you know, kids should not be using those substances under the age of 21. And of course, you shouldn't be using, you know, illegal drugs at any point.
But we are changing our attitude on marijuana, and I'm wondering how that will affect you and your job, and how it will affect prevention programs going forward. Because if we have states that are saying it's okay, you're not going to be arrested, it's not illegal to carry an ounce or whatever it is of marijuana around for your personal recreational use, if we adopt that attitude in more and more states and perhaps nationwide, what does that do to people like you who are trying to prevent drug abuse?
So John used the phrase a few minutes ago about perception of risk. By having these arguments out there in the public forum that, well, it's not that dangerous, it's fun, it should be legal, all of those things that minimize the dangers of marijuana or any other drug, the perception of risk from kids is that there is not a risk. And so an example of that is we do something called the Youth Drug Survey. And what we've seen since 2010 is that the perception of risk of tobacco use has gone up. So kids are not smoking because prevention efforts across the nation have worked. They're afraid to smoke. It's dangerous.
That's interesting.
But marijuana use is up.
Anecdotally, I will tell you that every person I see who smokes now is young.
That's targeted. They are a targeted population, purposefully targeted by marketing.
And I want to get to prevention again, but just as marijuana is beginning to ease into the culture and be seen in a more favorable light in some states, not North Carolina, alcohol, I mean, mommy and daddy have a cabinet full of it at home, and I see dad come home from work every day and he pours himself a gin and tonic or a bourbon and ginger ale or something like that, and he's okay, and we have my mom and dad have a glass of wine at dinner. They're okay. Well, why can't I go into the liquor cabinet and do it?
Well, you know, we've done a youth drug survey in Mecklenburg County since 1971, and there's a top three list, and the first two are almost always alcohol and marijuana. They might flip places every couple of years, and the third item on the top three flips depending on whatever is trendy. Right now it's heroin. Prior to that it was meth. Prior to that it was PCP or cocaine. But the top two, maintaining that they're, I mean, the alcohol and marijuana for 40 years, that tells us that our mindset, our acceptance, or our perception socially about these keeps them being acceptable.
Yes, but we have a different mindset about alcohol and marijuana. And if you're a 17-year-old or a 15-year-old, or actually it begins in middle school, so if you're a 12-year-old, what do you make of these mixed signals?
Well, I think it just needs to be explained to them as best as possible. I mean, The thing you're talking about going towards legalized marijuana and the perception, do we really want another legalized drug in the market out there that's, you know, going to cause, you know, more problems that, you know, it's just like, you know, alcoholism has caused a lot of problems. Do we want another drug out there adding to all the woes we have? I mean, a lot of people use marijuana, but the fact that it's illegal does keep the use down to some degree. And do we want to change that?
All right, well, the fact that states are legalizing, the fact that states are legalizing it for medical use, the fact that you watch the evening news and every commercial from the network is for a drug of some sort. How then? What impact does that have on prevention efforts? Because I know that prevention has to start is more most effective if it starts early.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to start early because, as we're going to find out here in a second, it starts in middle school. Drug use starts in middle school. What does this do to your ability to convince young people? And what does it do to the effectiveness of prevention programs that are already in place?
Well, the thing about prevention programs is it doesn't just have to be a curriculum that you teach in school. That's a piece of it. But it's also the conversations that we're having at this table today, a conversation you have with your children or your grandchildren. Prevention is really about teaching leadership skills and self-confidence and being bonded to your family or your community. Prevention is about having the same conversations about health and wellness and caring for one another and not being afraid to reach out for help if you have a behavioral illness or a medical illness. Prevention is really about helping everyone, from children to our senior citizens, helping everyone to achieve a better life. But because there's not an awareness of why all of these pieces matter, it's hard to have a cohesive effort. It brings up things like you were saying, well, okay, we're giving them mixed messages. Well, yes, we are. So what can we do to band together?
Well, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services estimates that early prevention and education programs would cause substance abuse initiation, the first use, to decline by 1.5 million young people and be delayed for 2 years on average. Mm-hmm. So what's the point of delay? The delay is that delay in onset reduces, evidently, subsequent problems later in life. So what sorts of educational programs, what sorts of informational programs seem to work best? You're the drug guy, so when you go into a school or your people go into school, what kind of results do they get, and with what do they get those results?
Well, I don't consider myself the prevention expert guy.
Okay.
But, you know, we generally, when we do the law enforcement portion of it, we speak more from, you know, the impact of drug abuse and what we see its impact on crime and, you know, violence and, you know, a life that, you know, that's completely against what, you know, we're all trying to be raised to be. I'll let Connie and Jane speak about specific programs. I know, you know, the Life Alert and some other programs are, you know, very effective. But, you know, we speak from the law perspective. In other words, if you go down this road, this is what could happen to you. You know, we'd rather you not go down this road, and that's where, you know, these experts give that perspective.
I think one of the important aspects is the use of young people who are actually in recovery, using peers.
Have them tell their story.
Exactly.
Well, I'm going to have you come back and talk more about that in a second. We have to take a break. That's Connie Mealy, who is a provider, director of Provided Behavioral Health Services for Mecklenburg County. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Foxcroft Wine Company, a full-service wine bar and retail shop located in the South Park area, featuring estate, artisanal, small production, and naturally made wines and fresh farm-to-fork cuisine. FoxcroftWine.com. Death and personal injury claims related to faulty ignition switches in 2.6 million General Motors cars can be filed starting on Friday. And on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they talk to Ken Feinberg, who led victim compensation efforts after 9/11, on the claims against GM, which he is now administrating. That's coming up in 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks will get you to us, as will Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
When you attend a WFAE public conversation, your voice can help shape the discussion.
And my fear is that we will settle for mediocrity in order to meet our budgets. And I just want to...
I guess this is a philosophical question for the entire room, which harkens back to the comment that where your passion is, there...
Get connected to past and future public conversations at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about drug prevention and behavioral problem prevention through early care, preventive care, with Jane Goble-Clark, Executive Director of the Center for Prevention Services. John Emerson is Deputy Director of the Atlanta Carolinas High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. And Connie Mealy is Director of Provided Behavioral Health Services for Mecklenburg County. And you were talking about one technique that seems to work very well with young people is bringing in other young people who have, in fact, had experiences with drugs to tell their story.
Yes. It's you just can't measure the impact that that has, because I think when and you asked a question earlier about if older people are talking about prevention or doing the prevention programs, are young people really going to listen? Well, they really listen when someone is 20 years old and talks about being addicted for the last 6 years of their life and how it affected their life and their family, where they were then. It's kind of sharing their experience, strength, and hope with the group.
Now, there was a recent survey of Charlotte Mecklenburg Middle School students, 2013 was when it was taken. It revealed that, this is shocking actually, 27.9% of these middle school students had had a drink of alcohol, 27.9%, 12% before the age of 11, nearly 13% had used marijuana. This is middle school. In high school, 29% had used marijuana in the past 30 days, and when you break that out according to grade point average, you discover that only 15.6% of the A students had smoked marijuana in the last 30 days, while 52.3% of the students making D's and F's did. Clearly, there is a correlation between marijuana use and what happens to you in life and your ability to perform, particularly at that level. And that means if you continue to do that, you're going to flunk out. You're not going to have a good life going forward because you're not going to get into college. You're not going to have the skills to have a decent job. It's a snowball.
That's where you look at it just the same way you would a medical, behavioral health or medical health. It's the same issue. If you think about the effects of marijuana causing lethargy and sort of that lack of drive, it's the same as having a physical illness where your energy is drained, your mental focus is drained, and it's very difficult to get ahead or finish your classes or graduate high school. It's really just about focusing on the physical effects and being able to treat those and prevent, in the case of drug abuse, prevent experimentation that causes those kind of physical ailments.
So do we know how many young people are experimenting with cocaine, with heroin, with other harder drugs than marijuana, if marijuana is the gateway and 52% of people making D's and F's who tried it in the last 30 days are token up?
Well, it's hard to have the exact numbers, but I think some of the continuation of that study there shows some numbers. There are heroin users in high schools here. There are cocaine users, although the numbers are much smaller than the marijuana. I mean, marijuana, I think, is about 50% of high school students have at least used marijuana once in their life, which exceeds the national and state average. So CMS is like about 10 percentage points above the state national average. I think the state national average is about 40%. So we're at like 50% here. So, but there are kids in high school. CMPD does a survey of the heroin users they come in contact with, and about 70% of those kids had gone to Charlotte area high schools. And 17% of them said they were using heroin while they were in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So it's out there, and it's something we have to get our head in the sand at.
Clearly, drug use is a behavioral issue, the word behavior seems to be I don't know that it's new in the profession, but to society at large, we used to call these drug problems and mental problems. Now we're calling them behavioral issues. Is that to try to remove the stigma of both of those issues?
I think that it is to help remove the stigma and help people understand that they are illnesses that affect the brain, which is what affects our behavior. Our brain is what guides us in everything that we do. And so, again, I think to help with the destigmatization of behavioral health issues is to talk about, you know, that these are illnesses that are affected because of what happens in the brain when a person uses alcohol or drugs.
It also relates back to the national prevention strategy, where that there's a focus on integrated care. So integrated care is addiction as well as mental health and wellness, and those two things combined are now behavioral health. So it destigmatizes, but it also combines.
You mentioned this national prevention strategy, which mm-hmm. I think was developed by the National Prevention Task Force, which was launched by the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And the strategy focuses on four main directions: creating healthy and safe community environments, ensuring that clinical and community preventive services are available, empowering people to make healthy choices, and eliminating health disparities. How do you empower people to make healthy choices? Aren't they already empowered to do that? It's up to you, isn't it?
It's about teaching the life skills. You know, we teach things like driving class. You have to take a class to get your license. You've got to pass the class. But we don't have that same mindset about teaching life skills. Our kids don't necessarily know how to make leadership choices or how to become self-confident. It might seem that people might be born that way, but it's also about teaching them to have those skills. So empowering people is about knowledge. Knowledge is power. Having conversations, not being afraid to have conversations about health or wellness or drug abuse or being bullied or domestic violence. Empowering people is about educating them.
And Connie, you've been doing this. You've been working in this field for more than several years. You're the director of providing behavioral health services for Mecklenburg County, but you've also been a staff nurse in a methadone clinic.
That's correct.
You've worked in a behavioral health clinic. You've spent 13 years working in the public mental health and substance abuse system. So you have a really experienced perspective on all of this. It's one thing to get regular checkups, to go and have your chest thumped and have your heartbeat listened to and maybe take a little blood and run it through the centrifuge. It's another thing to go in and be tested for drug problems, because that's something that a user would probably want to avoid because of the stigma attached to it. So how do you apply these preventive measures that we go in and don't think a thing about for high blood pressure and things like that to drug problems?
Well, there's an initiative and a program called ESPERT, which is screening and brief intervention and referral for treatment. And so the push is that any physician's office, when they're checking for all those things that you just described, would also include a questionnaire about what's called ESPERT, which is looking at the person's drinking or drug use and asking it in a very non-threatening manner.
Are they going to get honest answers?
Well, I hope that they will. The questions are worded
I'm going to sit at the table with the doctor or the nurse and say, oh, yeah, I do heroin every Thursday night.
Well, again, the hope is that we will get you to a point where you will be willing to at least share. What we know, Mike, is that adults minimize the amount of alcohol or drugs they use, and adolescents will typically give you amounts that are incompatible with life. They brag about how much they've been using, especially with other peers and with other friends. But I do believe that if physicians feel comfortable asking the questions, mm-hmm. which many physicians and nurse practitioners don't necessarily feel comfortable asking, but I think with training they can feel more comfortable.
Why don't you feel comfortable asking?
Because I think people think it's a bad thing, again, that it's stigmatized, and so they aren't necessarily looking at it as a disease and that we're trying to find out if this child or this adult has this disease, but it is making a moral judgment. So again, I think we have to help health professionals understand.
Well, you know, the only question I have ever been asked is, what's your alcohol intake by the week? How many drinks do you take every week, and what are they? That's all I've ever been asked.
And did you answer honestly, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's another piece of that national prevention strategy in this movement towards integrated care is one of the first levels of rolling this new way of doing things into the public is to try to do integrated care in primary care settings. The idea being that you've got your primary care doctor in this office as well as a behavioral health practitioner, so that if somebody says, well, yes, I'm using daily, then the doctor can triage in the behavioral health person immediately. But that's a mindset change. It's new. It's not
commonplace. I think a perfect example, Mike, is, you know, you could ask the question, well, do you how often do you drink? Once a week? Well, if you're a person who drinks every day, you're absolutely right. You're probably not going to say, well, I drink every day, because I've just suggested to you that once a week is normal. Mm-hmm. So I think it's asking, gee, so how much do you drink every day? A couple glasses of wine? Because that gives you more of an ability to hopefully be a little more honest. I still don't think you'll be totally honest with me, but a little more honest, because I've just kind of said, well, having a couple glasses of wine every day is okay. And so, again, I think it has a lot to do with how we ask the questions to try to get to the correct information. And I think it has to do with what the physician or nurse or behavioral health person says to the person about their drinking or drug use.
Obviously, certain drugs show up in the bloodstream. So are there blood tests that doctors, physicians do on people to determine whether or not they have those substances in their blood, or is that illegal to do without permission?
They certainly could do that. I don't think that that's the typical protocol for a physical, which may not be a bad idea, as you were describing mm-hmm. earlier. Let's do the cholesterol, triglycerides, fasting blood sugar.
If this is as big a problem as we say it is, mm-hmm. why aren't we doing it?
Yeah, exactly.
So at least you don't say, well, you should stop doing that right now.
Right.
But at least you would say, you know, I noticed that in your blood test you have heroin residue. Do you do this a lot?
Right. What's going on in your life? Why are you using heroin, or why are you drinking?
But if you get an answer that would indicate that the person is using too much alcohol, that they are using marijuana on a far too frequent basis, or any other drug for that matter, what do you do as a physician, as a healthcare professional? What do you do with that information?
Well, the ESPERT model really works around using motivational interviewing and motivational conversations. So what we know is to say to you, well, Mike, you can't use heroin anymore. You need to stop today. It's over. You know, we're going to send you to treatment right now. What I would say to you is, well, so what's going on? You know, when are you using the heroin? Why are you using the heroin? You know, have you ever thought about maybe cutting back on the use of your heroin?
Can you? I mean, seriously, if you get hooked on heroin, what's it like to get off of it?
It's withdrawal is not fun. It's very, if you think about the worst intestinal flu you had, it's probably about 3 to 4 times worse than that. It's not easy to get off of. But people can get off of, whether with medication or without. It's not an easy withdrawal, but you can get off. But with a conversation with a physician, that's part of what the physician could share with the person. If they say, well, yeah, I think I can cut back a little bit. Well, have you ever cut back before? What kind of withdrawal symptoms have you had? You know, maybe the best thing would be for us to send you to a program to be detoxed.
And that's something to remember, is that we need to make sure that there is that bridge. So when it's identified, there is a place or a program to send people to for help.
I don't want to just talk about drug abuse. I want to talk about prevention for mental health issues, because the last series of shootings, mass shootings in this country, have all been perpetrated by young men who have mental health issues, one of whom, the Sandy Hook shooter, was getting help, professional help, and it didn't seem to help. So, and there is this stigma attached to people who feel that they're having a mental issue. How do we expunge that stigma, and what prevention programs are available for people? Because sometimes you don't recognize that behavior in yourself.
Well, we should focus, too, on the times where it works. Unfortunately, the news likes to focus on things that bring immediate attention. And in that case, the child who was being challenged by behavioral health issues and had a really difficult outcome with them. But there are so many other cases where a behavioral health issue is identified early, therefore the right treatment or the right medication can be put in place, and there are completely different, much more positive and life-affirming outcomes.
The cost of all this, if the lack of preventive care, is not just... It doesn't just cost money to have preventive programs and cost more money to not have them. There's a societal cost. It's not just a medical cost. It is an incarceration cost, which is enormous today. Mm-hmm. Do we have any figures on what this is costing us overall?
For alcohol, drugs, and tobacco, the last story is about $510 billion a year it costs us.
$510 billion
a year.
Do we have any idea what it would cost if preventive programs were in place and funded to the level that they needed to be funded to get people not hooked in the first place?
Well, a couple of studies have shown that for every dollar you spend on prevention, you would save $10 to $18 down the road in treatment, law enforcement, incarceration. So that 18 to 1 ratio could be saved.
As we've said, preventive care is something that we haven't done a lot in this country because heretofore we've been rich and we just throw money at a problem when it crops up its ugly head and not to throw money at problems that don't exist yet. Are we making any headway toward making more programs available, finding the money for those programs? And do people believe you when you say, hey, this does work, by the way?
If they've had experience with a challenge, whether it's behavioral health or addiction, then yes, they know that it works. The thing that we need to remember is that with the Affordable Care Act and this national strategy, it's a 20-year plan. Unfortunately, we get caught up in the day-to-day, we're down in the weeds, and you kind of forget to rise up above and see the big picture. Prevention works, and the government is investing a lot of money into different programs that are prevention-focused, but again, over the next 20 years. And so we're an immediate gratification society. We want to see it now. Well, it's going to take time.
If you have insurance and it pays for preventive care, that's one avenue toward it. But if you don't, if you fall in that donut where you don't get Affordable Care Act, you can't afford it, et cetera, where do you go for preventive care?
Well, hopefully we're doing work with communities and churches and different places where kids may be, and certainly in the school system. We still don't have enough. We need more, but that's several of the places.
Connie Mealy is Director of Providing Behavioral Health Services for Mecklenburg County. John Epperson is the Deputy Director of the Atlanta Carolinas High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. And Jane Goble-Clark is Executive Director of the Center for Prevention Services. They have a website. You can check them out.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And that website for preventive services is really easy to remember. It's preventiveservices.org. Support for Charlotte Talks.